Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Daryl Tremue. And he will be speaking on The Earth is the Lord's, Environmental Ethics. So, let's listen in on Daryl.
We get the past in terms of our environment, and then our responsibility, assuming there is responsibility, and of course I'm taking the position there is, occurs in the present. But it occurs in the present in a very interesting aspect. That is, if you assume responsibility, you have to assume there's a future. We do know that at some point in time, the sun, which is a star, just a collection essentially of a variety of gases, will burn out. At that point in time, assuming that human beings haven't learned to colonize other planets with other stars, human life as we know it will end. The rate the sun is burning, we know it's not going to happen in our lifetime, unless we have vastly expanded lifetimes. And we don't anticipate that. So, we assume that in fact, the Earth is going to go on, you know, barring nuclear war, for a considerable amount of time. Thus, we have, I think, on some level, some sort of species responsibility, some sort of notion to leave the Earth in as hospitable a state as that which we inherited it. And of course, some people feel we need to clean it up. Now, some of our reasoning is done in prudential areas, that is, we're pumping up enough carbon monoxide in the air to cause global warming and or fluorocarbides to cut down the ozone layer. A lot of people don't believe that. The problem with the non-believers is proof is kaput. In other words, when the absolute proof would be the removal of the ozone layer and everybody getting skin cancer. And of course, at that point, it would be irrefutable and no one would be able to doubt it, and also the damage would probably be irreversible. That's the problem with dealing with some people who are non-believers. That is that the proof is disaster. Well, I haven't got much more really to share with you, except I'd like to talk with you about a bioethicist who's been very influential, Garrett Hardin, who's best known for, in particular, issues of population control. And Hardin's most famous area is lifeboat ethics, in which Hardin has us to imagine ourselves as a wealthy nation as being in a lifeboat. Third world nations and others are essentially people who got off the ship but somehow didn't get into the lifeboat and are floundering in the water and are asking for our help to get into the lifeboat. Hardin's reasoning goes along these lines. The lifeboat has a certain carrying capacity. Once that capacity has been exceeded, everyone in the lifeboat is threatened. Thus, it is imprudent, both in the present and in the future, to allow any but the carrying capacity in the lifeboat. That, in fact, the notion of commons has been extinguished, which I think he is right to a certain extent, but that we owe it to our future generation to preserve the value of the lifeboat. That's why his train of thought has been called lifeboat ethics. Of course, now, bringing up the issue that this gentleman raised, a lot of people understand that the Earth is, in fact, one huge lifeboat, so to speak, that a Brazilian rainforest farmers or ranchers want to cut down the Amazon to develop their country, much as we've cut down most of the primeval forest here, to develop our country, that, in fact, the Earth will produce enough oxygen for the rest of humanity. So that now, Hardin wrote really in the late 60s and early 70s, people are clearer that lifeboat ethics is in fact factually dubious. It was always dubious from a moral point of view, but now it's factually dubious. This is why people are negotiating with Brazilians to not cut down their rainforest, because life is in fact interconnected. and that in fact Brazilians have to live, and therefore we have to help them develop their country. We have to do so in ways that preserve our overall integrity of the planet for our species bias. That is, so we keep breathing air, and not all have to get some sort of skin blockers to walk around without getting skin cancer. Well, I also want you to think about the bombings out there. One of the things I am considered an expert in is political and economic ethics. And one of the things is the junction, the connection between environmental policy and economic policy. We have the benefits of having an economic interest here in the mountains, namely Holden, as I'm told, prospected around here. Notice that there were certain metals in the soil, state to claim began the mining operation that allowed for roads to be built here, for houses to be built here, and for us eventually to have a community here, a community in which we can contemplate God's goodness to us, and how we're to love each other, and how we're to care for the earth. Of course, mining, as in all industries, has a kind of downside, as you might say. We are stuck with contaminants also. According to our local geologists, a lot of the material still leaches in the soil, into the rivers. That's why we're doing the trout fishing along here. And that, in fact, there's been kind of considerable amount of ecological repair in terms of putting gravel in the tailings, planting trees in the tailings. And of course, none of this is done with money from the Howe Mining Company. So, one of the things we have to think about in terms of environmental ethics is in fact how we manipulate the earth. And when we realize we've made some mistakes, when we've polluted the earth, when we've over manipulated the earth, who gets to clean it up? Who pays for it? And in fact, what happens if we don't? A lot of people, in terms of Los Alamos and other areas, did not know that some of that nuclear testing could affect human health. That's the other thing we have to think about with all environmental manipulation. That is, we don't know everything. There is the problem of foreseeability. That when we do manipulate our environment, we're manipulating ourselves. And having said that, I basically don't have anything else to present to you, except to say that you can take a position that we do have an obligation to the future, and that this is the sticking point of most economic and environmental ethics. And I'll give you one example, and then I'll sit down and open it up to everybody else. The issue of the Great Northern Spotted Owl and the old timber growth. Environmentalists have taken the position that the Great Northern Spotted Owl needs, in fact, old timber growth to maintain itself as a species. Loggers have taken the position that though that may be true, the logging industry cannot maintain itself without continued cutting. And while I understand from an economic point of view the logging position, I have to think about the past, what has happened in this country. As in, for instance, part of the settlement of this country was the exploitation of the Newfoundland fishing beds, which are now exhausted. And the argument I try to make to loggers is, if you clear cut and cut all the trees now, the logging industry is bound to collapse. All you're doing is pushing present problems into the future, rather than trying to solve problems in the present so the future's not faced with them. So essentially, my argument against the loggers are, you're mortgaging our children's future. We have jobs now, but our children and logging way of life will come to an end. Unless we can log in a way in which we both log and plant trees so that there are trees for future generations to log. I don't understand how you can get at that equation differently, but I'm open to hear other explanations. Some of you may be loggers and know things that aren't.
I'm not a logger. I work for timber. But isn't our basis for our present and future problems continued population growth in the world?
Well,
the pressures that brings to bear.
I'll be honest with you. I used to think that until I traveled around the world and around the country. And what I see, from my opinion, is a problem of distribution. I used to think Europeans came to this country because Europe was teeming, that there really wasn't available land until I traveled into Europe. And when I rode on a train going 70 miles an hour from Paris to Barcelona and saw huge, vast stretches of Europe, of land that could be occupied that wasn't occupied, it began to occur to me that, in fact, what we have is a problem of distributing resources and a problem of use, of how we use the environment. But there's enough land to more than supply the number of, 4 billion plus people on the planet. At the same time, you and I finally are in agreement on some level because of the notion of scarcity. The planet is not going to grow. We can stick our thumbs in our mouths and hold our breaths, but there isn't going to be any more available land. At some point in time, there does have to reach a certain kind of balance between human population and environmental occupancy. I don't see human population as being the primary problem at present. And there's a lot of people working in the area who agree with me on that. Now, what do I mean by that? We're not going to get any more oceanfront property unless California really does belong in the ocean. Okay. So that, yeah, there is some crowding for certain kinds of use. But there's still a lot of I see a lot of just driving from Fort Worth, Texas here. There's a lot of arable, unoccupied land in this country and in other countries. The question is can we coordinate ourselves as a species for people to both occupy this land and also not to degrade the environment? And then finally, at some point in time, to limit our population.
But population is the reason that the resources are being consumed, and some are renewable and others aren't.
I think I do beg to disagree with you on that, because North America uses between 60% and 70% of all of the energy, but we don't have 60% to 70% of the population in the world. You see, but I've got my VCR too. I don't claim to. Notice, I'm not just pointing fingers. I'm trying to do is to understand that how we use resources are a political and moral choice. Yes, we have to really limit population if everybody has to have two cars, a two-car garage, and all the accoutrements of middle and upper middle class Western life.
I don't see in the near term where the United States is going to change that much. It's, like you said, it's political. 34% of our economy is based on making babies and building houses.
Yeah, but again, we are relatively intelligent species. And we can't, nobody's in disagreement that there is finally scarcity. I don't think anybody's taken the position here, or maybe there are, that we are necessarily going to find another planet. Therefore, we can kind of go along as we are when things start getting a little too crowded. Just shoot some folks out of the ship and start up another planet. That does solve the problem. Solves one problem. Of course, at some point in time, you got to find another planet. Or, some point in time, you've got to change how you live. Yes?
I live in the Midwest in Iowa, and we have this beautiful farmland. It's the Corn Belt of the United States. And they're selling their farms to build houses. And you mentioned a two-car garage. You're nothing if you don't have a three-car garage and 4 bathrooms. All the trees it's taking to build these big homes, they're retired couples or couples whose kids are gone off to college. And what do we do about that? It's a political status.
It really is an issue of values, really.
Yeah.
If it to be a fully human, in our society, you must be upper middle class and or rich, then we're going to have problems a lot sooner than if I mean, one of the things I did see in Europe is a lot of Europeans, much more than Americans, believe in apartments and condos. Mm-hmm. So the thing for you to have is to have a nice apartment near a major plaza, a major park, a major harbor, rather than everybody having the three-car garage, the four-bed, you know, the four-bathroom, 10-bedroom home.
And they're not rich, necessarily. They've got these big down payments, and when they get a divorce, and then, you know, you have a big...
Well, we don't want to get into that for now. This is just one little session that we've got a few more minutes.
It's beautiful farmland, and I live on the farm. I've watched what's happened to our farm.
It's happening everywhere.
It's used in occupancy, and the problem I find is, again, and here's where I go back towards my strength, which is political ethics, the question of politics and value identification. Part of it is the paucity of discourse. People don't talk about it. People look at lifestyles of the rich and famous and go for it, rather than ask themselves whether or not human beings are created for us, whether individually or groups, to have those kinds of destinies. What is the value of those destinies? You know, we have these parables in the Bible of the rich man, the rich foolish man, who talks about tearing down his barns one night and building others. And, you know, his life is taken from him. I don't claim to have all the answers, but I do think I can identify a lot of the problems. Yes.
You started off by asking us our attitude about environment. What kind of statistics are there as far as awareness is concerned about the average population, say, in the United States today versus 10 or 15 years ago? Is there really an increase in awareness and an increase in trying to do our part, or is that just talk?
In my opinion, you have two things going. I learned about ecology and environmentalism in the late 50s and early 60s because I went to the Newark Junior Museum, which was into ecology way back. However, what you didn't have way back was what I considered to be propaganda from certain concerns against environmentalism. So that now we have people who are more concerned about environmentalism, more concerned about ecology, but we also have more corporate interests who put out propaganda about how corporate entities are taking care of our environment. So you have, you know, oil companies that are, you know, doing all these great things, and, you know, some of it might even be true. But, you know, the Exxon Valdez disaster is not one that was not anticipated by Exxon. They knew that they could have double-hulled ships or single-hulled ships. And they knew, in terms of the probabilities of what happens in this world, human error, bad weather, call it lack of luck, anything you want to call it, ships do hit reefs, go, you know, hit the sand, beach themselves, whatever, and oil is spilled, and the double hulls prevent oil spills better than single hulls. And some corporate executive took the position that vis-a-vis the market, it would be more profitable to have single hull ships and not pass on the cost of double hull ships to consumers. And so, you know, nature took its course. The Exxon Valdez hit something off Alaska, spilled the oil. Exxon pledged to clean it up, spent some money on it, but in fact, most of the cleanup has been picked up by the United States citizen, taxpayer. And my position on that is, let the taxpayer pay for it.
At the pump.
Purchase at the pump.
You have to calculate the true cost
of getting oil and shipping it around the world, rather than have the taxpayer mugged in an alley. After the fact, you get mugged and people go through your pocket to pick up costs that they knew would have to be paid all along. But the problem is that you can vote for senators and congressmen, you can't vote for CEOs unless you're a stockholder.
One fact that I was unaware of, I consider myself pretty environmentally aware, but clearly I'm not, is that I think it's one or two tankers a day come into the, from Alaska, come into the refinery facilities near Anacortes, Washington.
they come up the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and then they have to navigate a very narrow and rather treacherous channel to reach these refineries. And this, there has to be one or two ships a day, 365 days a year, just to feed the petroleum needs of this region, Washington and Oregon.
Sure.
Idaho. And sooner or later, one of those ships is going to run aground, and we're going to have a major oil spill in the upper Puget Sound, eastern end of the Juan de Fuca Straits. Once again, we'll be faced with the true cost.
Yeah.
And maybe if you don't have the voting rights to do something about the CEOs, but we could ask our state legislators to create a law that requires the double hull.
Sure. And that's very good, practical, political, ethical thinking. But what you need to do that, you'll have to extend it, as in we have to have some control over lobbyists.
Yeah.
On how campaign funds are raised. Because we have these other good thoughts, that's an excellent thought. But when it comes time for a congressman to vote, and he needs money for election, and you don't have very strict laws about how you can get campaigns, and you have lobbyists around, what happens is our vote tends to go to the lobbyists and to corporate interests rather than the citizens. So that ties back into environmental ethics, because finally, it's the polis, it is the government. And at least in democratic theory, it's the people who control corporate interests. Except, as my old professor Jose Miguez Bonita would say, essentially, you've got a certain technocracy which has escaped democratic control. And so what I'm trying to get people to do is to think about how to reassert control over policy making. And it touches environmental issues, it touches all public policy. But if we consider ourselves free citizens, then we should be able to call interests into question. Yes, ma'am.
I was just thinking that a year ago in Iowa, you know, we were having the big flood, and now there's a discussion as to whether or not the Corps of Engineers has been right in all the dams and levees that have been built. And Davenport did not have a levee, so of course we flooded the downtown area. Rock Island across the river had a levee, and they were spared. So they're weighing, you know, is it going to be worth the millions to build a levee in Davenport and protect, you know, from the floods? Or are they going to allow the flood plain, you know, to take over? Because unfortunately what happened with all the dams and levees is just all the water, you know, was funneled up, and then where there was a break, it went over.
Wow.
And so this is what, you know, politicians and people now are, you know, and wrestling with what do they do. So, and the Corps of Engineers has kind of changed its idea that maybe they have been wrong in building all of the dams.
Well, the blame is not really just with the Corps of Engineers.
One thing
about New Jersey is that we tend to have gotten in before most of America. Well, we have a town called Wayne, New Jersey, that just basically annually floods. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the Corps of Engineers, it's also your city planners.
Well,
should you allow building in floodplain zones?
When Fern was talking about the houses that had been built, 4 years before that, we had a bad flood on a creek, a very small little creek. And it was because they had built a large shopping center, one of the largest in Iowa, and other things. There was nothing to hold the rainfall. And so when it got a really heavy rain, you know, the creek came up and flooded areas that had never been flooded before. Very nice residential areas. So there's thinking, you know, what are they going to do about the creek, too? You know, which is a long way from the river.
Yeah.
No connection at all yet. And they haven't made, the people that have built the shopping centers have a, what do they call it?
Pool.
Runoff. Yeah.
Runoff.
Routine or something, you know, to hold that.
Yeah.
And it's just running off the concrete, you know.
And they're building more and more hotels and motels. It's all concrete.
There's nothing.
So where is the water going to go?
Water seeks its lowest level, wherever that is. And if that happens to be your living room,
that's
your living room.
And you don't think a creek is very powerful. when it's just flowing along. But when I'm a block from it, it came down my way, it knocked out two walls of my house and came up 3 feet in all around the house.
Yeah, engineers know that, but it's, you know, you don't have a coordination in this country with engineers and city and civic planners.
The problem is, money always talks.
Yeah, money always.
We want to build the shopping center. Right. Yeah.
They're moving some towns.
That's true.
If they're small enough, they're moving them out of the floodplain and up to the higher ground.
Yes.
I guess the question that I would raise in listening to everything we've talked about is, what can we do as individuals on an individual basis, wherever we might live in America?
I would say that basically there's nothing you can do as individuals. What you can do is get together with other individuals in your churches and talk about public policy on a lot of issues, including the environment. And then talk about the notion of independent citizens making the government responsible for what industry does, and making whatever changes you need in the law to make our elected officials protect our environment. That's basically going to be the answer. I mean, it's good to be also personally cognizant of things of waste, use of styrofoam, wasteful use of electricity, and change our own personal values. And I'm all for that, but I'm a firm believer that most basic bad policy is done corporately, and the solutions will have to be done corporately.
There are some corporations who have pledged and demonstrated certain kinds of environmental responsibility, and something that individuals can do is knowing what those corporations are and purchase their products.
Mm-hmm. Very good suggestion. Mm-hmm. Excellent suggestion.
And purchase their stock.
And purchase their stock, purchase their products, and also be in touch with nonprofit agencies that you see listed in books like this, Environmental Ethics, that in fact keep an eye on the environment. And write them, let them know you support them, contribute to them, and to the corporations that show environmental responsibility. That's
and talk about that with your friends and neighbors so that they become more aware about that too.
Yeah. So we can build a consensus, even as individuals, but we can't by keeping them as purely private opinions. I think it's better for me to express my opinion and be wrong as long as I listen to other people. There's at least the possibility I could get right.
You know,
than not share my opinion.
And it's helpful that the Corps of Engineers is reassessing, you know, what might, you know, be the future of the, you know, Mississippi Valley and the floodplain and that type of thing.
Sure.
When the powers that be allowed that shopping center to come in, were they realizing, did they know, did they understand that these homes that had been built a long time before in a safe place would then be in a precarious place? Or did they find out when the flood came and it hit? And
it was like a 100-year flood.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it flooded twice in 3 weeks
to
a level that's a 100-year flood. Mm-hmm. So those, no, they had no idea. I don't believe that those houses were flooded.
Yes.
So those houses would not likely have flooded, even with a 100-year flood, had the shopping center not been there, allowing the water to not go down into the ground in that pool area.
Probably the flood would not have been
preventing the water from going outside.
You know, one thing that disturbs me as I look around this room is none of us really are teenagers.
I think they're more aware than we are.
I don't know.
That's the question I raise. I don't know that they're that much aware. I get real scared about that propaganda.
I just can't look around the room. This guy looks like he might be the youngest. He looks younger than me anyway.
Again, getting back to me living on the farm, agriculture gets such feedback on putting too much fertilizer. We cannot afford to put 1 ounce more fertilizer on our ground than will absorb the soil and not wash off.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of wash off, but we can't afford to put more. But I have friends in town that have a regular schedule of the fertilizer and weed sprayer coming. You know, they're not even home, they just spray how many times a year.
That's right.
And that runs right in the sewer, but farmers get on the plane.
Farmers aren't getting on the plane. I agree with you. You know, the thing is again, we don't talk enough, farmers and urban people, about really who's profiting from this system and what are the, as this gentleman so accurately pointed out, what are the true costs of our policy? Because when you know, the final, when it comes down to it, people will you know, love canal, all of these things. Somebody's going to finally end it up. The question is, how much damage is going to be done to the environment, to the human populations, and then who's going to pay for it? And probably other things I can't think of off the top of my head, but those are three very important issues. And, you know, I'm a little disturbed that we don't have a lot more younger people here because, in fact, as we move off the stage, they should be moving on, and, you know, you would like to think they're going to be here when the decisions we've made manifest themselves more clearly. So.
Don't they have their own program here in Holden?
Well, yeah, I was even thinking of just younger adults, you know, but, I guess people go with what interests them.
I live in Seattle, we live in Seattle, and Seattle schools, I think, have a pretty good environmental education program, so there's a goal.
There's a way.
Of course, my wife and I fulfill our duties as parents, but we should be instilling.
Well, this is something the church could intervene on. Yes, ma'am.
Well, when I go to the recycling center in Bettendorf, I see a lot of young people, young families, and the small children help carrying in the egg cartons and the newspapers and the plastic bottles. And anytime I go, there's always people.
I think the difference with the young people probably is that many young people just assume, of course you recycle. There isn't a question of whether you recycle. That's part of their way of life.
Yeah, the thing that disturbs me, I live in a city, Fort Worth, that has, by law, recycling. I mean, you've got your bid, you've got to put your newspaper in it, and you've got to separate it from your other garbage and your plastic and put it in the bin. But that is not really what you, it didn't really come out of what you call intelligent public policy. It's all the landfills got filled. You know, it's always kind of after the fact. You know, the horses are completely out of the barn, now let's close the doors. Which is better than never closing the doors, I guess. But it's totally exactly inspiring. Yes.
But all that we can do as individuals, as talking with one another, as churches, how is that going to do one cotton picking thing as long as the major corporations, the big business, can afford all this expensive lobbying, and we don't address that?
Well, we have to address it. I mean, that's really it.
You can,
because you can begin to talk about and sponsor people who run for office who, in a number of ways. Here's one of the things that really ticked me off, is that congressmen wanted, and women wanted increased salaries, and we voted against it. It's one of the worst moves we could make. I have a lawyer, I pay his fees, he represents me. I have a doctor, I pay his fees, he cares for me. I have anybody who is supposed to represent me. And, you know, if they're not doing a good job, I go to someone else. But at least while we're in the contractual relationship, I understand them if you're representing us. If we really want our senators and our Congress people to represent us, then we need to pay all their fees. And if it means that when you run for Congress, you make $200,000 a year, it's still cheaper. Because what winds up through perks and through bad public policy, we wind up paying more anyway. And I'd rather have it go there and have stricter laws about gifts, about campaign finances, and about a variety of perks so that I can see where my tax dollar is going in a much more straight-line fashion. So I was all for giving senators and congresspeople raises, because then it permits more people to listen less to lobbyists and other influential groups out there who are not subject to me as a citizen.
But isn't the real issue the huge cost of political campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And by doubling the salary of a congressperson, you aren't doing anything about
But Washington is a tough place to live in terms of the cost.
Well, yeah, okay. I think what you say is valid, but I don't think it really gets to the real point.
I think you're right there.
Yeah,
I think we do have to have that. I think the mistake is people talk about term limits, but that's a serious mistake. The worst thing in the world you want are really inexperienced politicians who then are even more susceptible to lobbyists because they only have one or two terms. I think the issue you brought up is really the central one, the question of how we spend money to get elected, how we gather it, and how we spend it. That really is the crux of it. And again, the church and citizens, we can pass laws, we can limit that. But we have to take the bull by the horns, so to speak. And this goes beyond environmental ethics, back to my area I like better, which is political ethics. But it's connected. It really is connected. What other issues people want to talk about?
Well, if our churches would band together like ARC does, I'd embarrass what our seniors do, the lobbying they do. Because what's going to be left for our young people? You know, the poor, poor don't get the benefits of the McDonald's free coffee and all of these discounts we get. They can't get those places. If the churches could band together and get a lobby effect like the ARC has there, we'd do something. But we never get the churches together like that, do we?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the churches have banded together on some issues. I have to talk about the Clapham Second Inlet that forced the English politicians to stop the slave trade in the British colonies. And the church has been an effective agent in making social change in human history. I mean, we did it before, and we can do it again. We get that kind of spirit. And talk to each other to get a better idea about what we should be doing. I'm a firm believer in participatory government. I think most people can use a variety of ethical styles and even have a good deal of variance in their values. But if you get enough people talking together, I'm firmly convinced that you can get decent policy out of it. But what I see as the problem is the constriction of discourse. Of people being alienated from each other, not talking to each other about their problems, of everybody thinking their problems solely addressed to them and they have to deal with the problem, and everybody being in competition with everybody else. And that's, I think, is what prevents us from doing the right thing.
As far as the senior citizen discounts, there are poor senior citizens also, and they really appreciate getting those discounts.
Well, there's something to be said for that. I'm not getting into another field. I get to deep water drown real quick. Other concerns? Anybody worried here?
Worried?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm worried, yeah.
Concerned.
Concerned about propaganda for young people, particularly. How can they sit that out?
Well, I think we do have to make changes in education and in public policy.
I mean, I think about our, 14,000 young people who are going to Atlanta in a couple of weeks for a gathering, and, how much are they going to get when they're there that'll really get them to think?
I think you might get some of this there.
Yeah, they will. For what purpose? Yeah, for what purpose?
Every 4 years, the Lutheran Church has a youth gathering somewhere in the nation. I think there is going to be 13 or 14,000 young people who will be attending that now, the end of July in Atlanta. And this is the time when I guess I really hope that we can stand as a church and, really stimulate some thinking.
Yeah, I think that's good.
And thinking about the environment, but what is the purpose of that gathering? Is the purpose to help more young people come to know Jesus, or? What is the purpose of a gathering?
And I think a community involvement, Christian gathering, from around not just the United States, even people from around the world.
That's good.
If they're only getting together to get together.
No, this isn't.
So I'm asking, what is the point? Well, why are they getting together?
It's a religious rally. And if it's a religious rally, they'll surely get environmental subjects and stuff.
I would like to think that.
I'm sure they will. They come back every time, just so inspired. They'll still want their automobile, of course, when they get back.
Well, that is something we do have to begin to finally address. We know that the city of Los Angeles used to have per capita more mass transportation, and then industrialists basically discontinued, I think it was the trolley or the subway there, and now we have LA. Environmental problems there, primarily because it worshipped at the altar of the oil tank, the car. It sometimes does come down to individual interest. How many cars can you feel good about having? How much, energy do you feel is somehow your share? And these are difficult questions as to, what is our share, particularly when it comes to the issue of, as Adam Smith would say, we take very strong social cues, If Joey is a 17-year-old who lives down the block and probably works the same place I work, he's got a car, maybe my daughter has to have a car. We get into these things because, unfortunately, as human beings, we make comparisons. And in this country, in particular, we are susceptible to consumerism. So I think we have to identify some of these powerful consumer interests and try and understand that we are part of that system, that we contribute to it, both the good things about it and the bad things about it.
You know, it's a terrible irony that they got the Santa Monica Freeway up and going again in a few months after the earthquake in South Central LA. Just about the way it was right after the riots.
Well, everybody takes care of what's the most important. Across all ethnic, age, racial groups, whatever is invaluable, people take care of. You were going to say, Karen?
Yeah, I don't think we can discount the influence of TV. The way we think about consuming. We think it's important
for the 16
and 17 year olds to have cars. We can think of all kinds of arguments for ourselves and our kids to have the things that they see advertised.
Yeah.
Even though we also are capable of thinking of a few reasons why maybe they shouldn't, but they can be so easily overpowered by.
Very easily, I think the notion of temptation hasn't changed in Christ's day, except it maybe has expanded. But I just want to close on one issue. Who really is the political kind of icon of America? And I would suggest to you is probably closer to Donald Trump than it is Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. And we need to think about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.